welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And your campaign begins 3-4 months ago. So you need to get hot, need to get going on your campaign. And on top of that, if you are a believer in prayer, the power of prayer, then make sure that you get involved if you believe in that group prayer or what have you. But please make your appeal to heaven. Can't do it without his help. And as we just spoke about in our last show, we talked about Benjamin Franklin actually being the catalyst or the one who recommended that they appeal to heaven. And so, welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
And, no, thank you. Thank you for making the time to do all of this. I know that you are juggling, well, not kids, but I know you're juggling a lot of things. So, we had covered the Pinckney plan, the New Jersey and Pinckney plan, or the Virginia and the New Jersey plan, or the Pinckney plan. And we also covered a couple of comments on the electors as well as the concerns over the commission. And so let's dive down to the importance of the Senate and what they, you know, brought to the table. So this is Mr. Speight. And I mean, let's just pick it up from right here and we'll go a little ways because this goes on for a while. But anyway, okay. Let's just go ahead and pick it up from the importance of the Senate.
Okay. So Mr. Speight contended that the second branch ought to be chosen by the state legislatures and moved an amendment to that effect. Mr. Butler apprehended that the taking so many powers out of the hands of the states, as was proposed, tended to destroy all that balance and security of interests among the states which it was necessary to preserve, and called on Mr. Randolph, the mover of the propositions, to explain the extent of his ideas, and particularly the number of members he meant to assign to this second branch.
Keep going. So Mr. Rand.
Mr. Rand observed that he had, at the time of offering his proposition, stated his ideas as far as the nature of general propositions required, that details made no part of the plan, could not perhaps with propriety have been introduced. If he was to give an opinion as to the number of the second branch, he should say that it ought to be much smaller than that of the first, so small as to be exempt from the passionate proceedings to which numerous assemblies are liable. He observed that the general object was to provide a cure for the evils under which the U.S. labored, that in tracing these evils to their origin, every man had fought it in the turbulence of the follies of democracy, that some check, therefore, was to be sought for against this tendency of our governments, and that a good Senate seemed most likely to answer the purpose.
Okay, so Mr. Speight is from North Carolina, and he was basically trying and introduced this concept that the state legislatures choose the Senate because they're just chewing on this and, you know, trying to figure this out. But again, it was the compromise, maybe not the architect, but the compromise that Roger Sherman basically, you know, brought the sides together. Come on, look, you know, us small states, because he was from a small state. He was from Connecticut. And so Mr. Sherman was saying, come on, guys, we're getting our protection here. We're going to have our people in that House of Representatives, and then we'll also have the state legislature's suffrage or representation, because they didn't get to that part yet, but the representation would be chosen by the state legislature. Okay, so Mr. Rand, I'm trying to remember where he was from, and so I'm going to guess that he was probably from another small state. Let me check here. Where is Rand? Rand. Not jumping out. He wasn't from New York. And so I'll have to figure out where he's from while you read the next. But let's go on to Mr. King, because he's from Massachusetts.
Okay. Mr. King reminded the committee that the choice of the second branch, as proposed by Mr. Spate, viz., by the state legislatures, would be impractical, unless it was to be very numerous, and the idea of proportion among the states was to be disregarded. According to this idea, there must be 80 or 100 members to entitle Delaware to the choice of one of them. Mr. Spate withdrew his motion.
Okay. Mr. Wilson, now actually, I got bit by an acronym. Madison uses RAND, short for Randolph.
Oh, yeah.
So when we see that, we know who we're talking about.
Mr. Randolph.
Okay. Because, folks, when you're reading this, you're gonna see them, too. They're actually, abbreviating. So, all right. Now, you did Mr. King. So Mr. Wilson from Pennsylvania says this.
Mr. Wilson opposed both the nomination by the state legislatures and an election by the first branch of the national legislature, because the second branch of the latter ought to be independent of both. He thought both branches of the national legislature ought to be chosen by the people, but was not prepared with a specific proposition. He suggested the mode of choosing the Senate of New York, to wit, of uniting several election districts for one branch and choosing members for the other branch as a good model.
Okay, then Mr. Madison.
Mr. Madison observed that such a mode would destroy the influence of the smaller states associated with larger ones in the same district, as the latter would choose from within themselves, although better men might be found in the former. The election of senators in Virginia, where large and small counties were often formed into one district for the purpose, had illustrated this consequence. Local partiality would often prefer a resident within the county or state to a candidate of superior merit residing out of it. Less merit also in a resident would be more known throughout his own state.
So do you see that? So how common is it, folks, today that we hear people actually bring up in a candidacy, somebody that's running, this person's not from here?
Yeah, every time.
Every that's time, because they use that. That's demagoguery right there. Well, that person's not really one of us. And that is so destructive, because let me just think here. If James Madison somehow was, came back to life, from some, his spirit, took over somebody, and it was kind of obvious this guy was brilliant on the Constitution. He moved to Wyoming, and he barely got his residency, and he actually ran for governor. Would Wyoming actually weigh over the fact of whether he was from there or whether this man had the brilliance of James Madison and practically proven to be so?
Yeah.
See how destructive the paradigm is when we're looking at what does that have to do with a person being able to serve? This is why I believe focus should be on the test, that we need to test our representatives, we need to test our candidates, how well they know the Constitution. Just like, you test doctors, whether they can actually do their job. Everybody has a competency test. The one competency that we all need and the one merit that we all should be focused on is how well do these people understand the Constitution? Because if they don't understand it, they're going to have no idea how they're trashing it.
Yeah. Okay. If we use that against Liz Cheney, though, it's okay.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
Okay, so Mr. Sherman then pipes in.
Mr. Sherman favored an election of one member by each of the state legislatures.
Then Mr. Pinckney moved to strike out the, quote, nomination by the state legislature, close quote, on this question. And then so he moved it, and then this was the outcome of that. No. So in other words, how many yeses were there?
None.
Yeah.
I don't see any of them.
In other words, he went down in flames. On the whole question, for electing the first branch out of nominations by the state legislature, that actually went down in flames as well. So the concept of Wilson and even Madison was favoring the election of the first branch by the people. This kind of became revealing that, you know, they did want to put the power in the hands of the people, even though it was brought up several times how stupid the people were. It was even brought up in the Federalist Papers that we're trusting illiterate people to be able to, you know, to get involved in government, right? But they created a constitution that required, you know, very specific empowered only very specific powers and so forth. As long as everybody understood the manual, there was going to be no problem. Ah, but it's not a matter of whether somebody understands it. It's because there's those people that read it, not to understand it, but to understand how they can undermine it and take advantage. Those are the real people we have to actually be careful of.
Okay. Hamilton.
Okay. There you go. I might be rubbing off on you. I don't know. Okay. So at this point, then we're going to kind of cruise down. And what I need you to do is go all the way down to Saturday, June 2nd in the navigation pane. And that's all the way down there. And they're going to talk again a little bit about electors from Wilson, Jerry, and so forth. So, or Gary. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see what they're talking a little bit more about. And because you'd be surprised what we can garner from the way they talk and debate these things. So let's go ahead.
So you want me to start the Committee of the Whole?
No, actually with...
Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Wilson, right.
Okay. So Mr. Wilson made the following motion to be substituted for the mode proposed by Mr. Randolph's resolution that the executive magistracy shall be elected in the following manner: that the states be divided into districts, and that the persons qualified to vote in each district were members of the first branch of the national legislature elect, members for their respective districts to be electors of the executive magistracy, that the said electors of the executive magistracy meet at, and they or any of them, so shall proceed to elect by ballot, but not out of their own body, person in whom the executive authority of the national government shall be vested.
Okay, so those were illegible parts of the text. So, .. Guess what he wrote. Okay, so Mr. Wilson repeated his argument in favor of an election without the intervention of the states. He supposed to that this mode would produce more confidence among the people in the first magistrate, i.e. being the executive, but they were still looking at this point in time of having general powers. They actually didn't start defining and confining the federal government to very specific powers, and that he couldn't create law and those types of things. So they were still looking at the magistrate. Now, Mr. Gary basically talks a little bit more about electors. Go ahead.
Mr. Gary opposed the election by the national legislature. There would be a constant intrigue kept up for the appointment. The legislature and the candidates would bargain and play into one another's hands. Votes would be given by the former under promises or expectations from the latter of recompensing them by services to members of the legislature or to their friends. He liked the principle of Mr. Wilson's motion, but fears it would alarm and give a handle to the state partisans as tending to supersede altogether the state authorities. He thought the community not yet ripe for stripping the states of their powers, even such as might not be requisite for local purposes. He was for waiting till people should feel more the necessity of it. He seemed to prefer the taking of suffrages of the states instead of electors, or letting the legislatures nominate and the electors appoint. He was not clear that the people ought to act directly, even in the choice of electors, being too little informed of personal characters in large districts and liable to deceptions.
Okay, so they're kind of pointing out the uniqueness of using electors that actually make the choices not to govern. Okay, so Mr. Williamson basically then commented. Go ahead.
Mr. Williamson could see no advantage in the introduction of electors chosen by the people who would stand in the same relation to them as the state legislatures, whilst the expedient would be attended with great trouble and expense. On the question for agreeing to Mr. Wilson's substitute, it was
negatived. In other words, they voted against it. And on the question for electing the executive by a national legislature for the term of 7 years, not four, it was agreed to by Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York. Pennsylvania was the only one that voted no, along with Maryland. Everybody else voted yes. And, you know, those two states were the states that were non-denominational Christian. Interesting. Just a coincidence. The planets aligned at that point in time. Okay, so now we're going to peruse down. And we got more electors. We actually kind of cruise through June as they're just struggling. They're literally going through long, tedious arguments of merits for electors, merits for this, merits for that. And so let's go to way down to Saturday, June 16th, 1787. Mr. Lansing, who's an anti-federalist, he was not one that signed the Constitution, but Mr. Lansing was making a comment regarding the commission.
Mr. Lansing, okay. Mr. Lansing called for the reading of the first resolution of each plan, which he considered as involving principles directly in contrast. That of Mr. Patterson says he sustains the sovereignty of the respective states. That of Mr. Randolph destroys it. The latter requires a negative of all the laws of the particular states. The former, only certain general powers for the general good. The plan of Mr. Randolph, in short, absorbs all power except what may be exercised in the little local matters of the states, which are not objects worthy of the supreme cognizance. He grounded his preference. Mr. Patterson's?
Yeah, Mr. plan. Patterson's plan. Okay. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Mr. Patterson's plan, chiefly on two objections against that of Mr. Randolph's want of power in the convention to discuss and propose it. The improbability of its being adopted.
Okay, so actually, you see where we are right now, right? And he goes through this listing. Actually, if you go up, because I jumped over, I realized that I just actually missed it. If you go up, you can see the New Jersey plan. Now, we already had the New Jersey plan printed, and they're kind of talking again about the New Jersey plan. And then Mr. Sherman brings in, basically, among the Sherman's papers was found a document containing a series of propositions which has been variously interpreted. The members of the Connecticut delegation, now this is not out of Madison's notes, I believe. The members of the Connecticut delegation of the Federal Convention had served upon several different committees of Congress that had proposed amendments to the Articles of Confederation. And this document embodies some of the amendments thus proposed by L.H. Buell in his Life of Roger Sherman, treats it as having been prepared in the latter part of Sherman's service in Congress, and, quote, as embodying the amendments which he deemed necessary to be made to the existing government. Bancroft, on the other hand, regards it as a plan of government presented to the Federal Convention, which in its importance stands next to that of the Virginia plan. Neither of these interpretations is acceptable to the editor, who is inclined to consider these documents more probably presenting the ideas of the Connecticut delegation in forming the New Jersey plan. It's accordingly reprinted here as follows, the Roger Sherman. And there you go. So go ahead and take it from here.
Roger Sherman, that in addition to the legislative powers vested in Congress by the Articles of the Confederation, the legislature of the United States be authorized to make laws to regulate the commerce of the United States with foreign nations and among the several states in the Union, to impose duties on foreign goods and commodities imported into the United States and on papers passing through the post office for raising a revenue, and to regulate the collective thereof, and apply the same to the payment of the debts due from the United States and for supporting the government and other necessary charges of the Union. To make laws binding on the people of the United States and on the courts of law and other magistrates and officers, civil and military, within the several states in all cases which concern the common interests of the United States, but not to interfere with the government of the individual states in matters of internal in matters of internal police which respect the government of such states only, and wherein the general welfare of the United States is not affected. Okay. That the laws of the United States ought, as far as may be consistent with the common interests of the Union, to be carried into execution by the judiciary and executive officers of the respective states wherein the execution thereof is required. That the legislature of the United States be authorized to institute one supreme tribunal and such other tribunals as they may judge necessary for the purpose aforesaid and ascertain their respective powers and jurisdictions. That the legislatures of the individual states ought not to possess a right to emit bills of credit for a currency or to make any tender laws for the payment or discharge of debts or contracts in any manner different from the agreement of the parties, unless for payment of the value of the thing contracted for in current money, agreeable to the standard that shall be allowed by the legislature of the United States, or in any other manner to obstruct or impede the recovery of debts, whereby the interests of foreigners or the citizens of any other state may be affected. That the eighth...
He's talking about the eighth article of the Confederation.
Yeah.
Okay.
That the eighth article of the Confederation ought to be amended, agreeable to the recommendation of Congress on the whatever
on
day
this
they
day
have decided.
Of,
yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. That if any state shall refuse or neglect to furnish its quota of supplies upon requisition made by the legislature of the United States, agreeably to the Articles of the Union, that said legislatures be authorized to order the same to be levied and collected of the inhabitants of such state, and to make such rules and orders as may be necessary for that purpose.
Mm-hmm. Keep going.
That the legislature of the United States have power to make laws calling forth such aid from the people from time to time as may be necessary to assist the civil officers in the execution of the laws of the United States, and annex suitable penalties to be inflicted in case of disobedience. That no person shall be liable to be tried for any criminal offense committed within any of the United States, in any other state, than wherein the offense shall be committed, nor be deprived of the privilege of trial by a jury by virtue of any law of the United States.
Okay, so then they adjourn for the day. So they heard Mr. Sherman present this. And so what we have is actually an overlay that sits kind of on the Articles of Confederation, but you can actually see how this would lift up, and he's literally talking about this new forming of the Constitution. Technically, we're going to go into break, so I'm going to actually look ahead, because the formation of the Constitution, they go from resolutions to resolutions to resolutions before they even start forming articles and such of the framework of the Constitution. So I'm going to look ahead and let you know that the beginning of the formation of the Constitution being laid out of what's to be included in what articles and so forth, when that actually began to occur in the convention, because it's a lot later than most people think. They were really pounding out these nuances of these principles and processes. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so as I'm perusing through this, I mean, I'm already down to August 20th, and I don't think I've seen my note where the Constitution actually starts taking formation. And so I'll have to go back through this because it's got to be somewhere in here. And I thought that by this point in time, it would have been formed, or at least it would have started creating, because when they finally moved away from resolutions is when they got there. But anyway, where we are right now, what I'd like to do is I'd actually like to skim way down. And Mr. Lansing makes a comment, because in being faithful to this concern of staying within the commissions. Now, I would think that the large states would be far more concerned over giving up power. And so Mr. Lansing of New York, who was an anti-federalist, he was really against this, but he stayed in, I believe he stayed for the majority of the convention. And I know Hamilton had left, and I think there was a point in time when they didn't have anybody there from New York, and Hamilton came back. But I believe Lansing was there for probably the most part of this, because this is June 20th. And this is, are you down to June 20th and Mr. Lansing and the commission?
June 20th. That's Mr. Ellsworth.
Okay, actually, so that's Mr. Ellsworth, but yeah, Lansing is the one that, but actually, let's go up to June 19th and the admission of states, okay? Because this is, I think, the first time, let me look at it, admission of new states, let me see here, we got it here, so I'm going to see, it happens above. So what happens right above the Sherman Plan was a resolution resolved that a provision be made for the admission of new states, okay? So that was way back up on June 15th. Now down to June, what we talked about, 19th, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so down June 19th, there's this little note where they talk about resolved, and there's a little more detail to the admission of new states. And this is what it says. I'm trying to remember. This is Mr. Madison. He's talking about making these new resolutions. Resolved we do this, resolved we do this. So now this is the first time they've actually added language to, you know, having some dealing with the admission of states. It says, resolve that provision ought to be made for the admission of new states lawfully arising within the limits of the United States, whether from a voluntary junction of government and our territory, or otherwise with the consent of a number of voices in the national legislature less than the whole. So they're basically starting to add language to this. And we're going to notice down below, they're actually going to talk more and more about it, because as they really bring this subject up, and we're talking almost a month later, They're just getting into these details when they finally trip over this idea of bringing states into the union that would be handicapped. In other words, they wouldn't enjoy the same privileges and sovereignty as the first states. And we talked, I know I mentioned this, but that was, people, leap into these ideas that sound really good because it gives us, the control over the direction of this nation and so forth. And they forgot, some of these men completely forgot, they didn't like the control that they were in under Britain. And so even though it was brought up, it's still, I think Mason and a few other Virginians kind of, poked him in the eye. Are you sure? I think there's some other people in the room. But it just wasn't enough to change the sentiments of the delegates at that point in time. They kind of wanted to have, hey, we're creating this all-powerful Oz, and we want to hold the power. Anyway, okay, so from the admission of new states, right, down to this next comment by Mr. Lansing. Do you see that now? It's an indent underneath Mr. Lansing. On June 20th, there's Ellsworth, Randolph, and then Lansing.
Yes.
Okay. And so let's just read this commission comment.
Observed that the true question here was whether the convention would adhere to or depart from the foundation of the present Confederacy, and moved instead on the second resolution that the powers of legislation be vested in the United States and Congress. He had already assigned two reasons against such an innovation as was proposed. One, the want of competent powers in the convention. Two, the state of the public mind. It had been observed by Mr. Madison in discussing the first point that in two states, the delegates to Congress were chosen by the people. Notwithstanding the first appearance of this remark, it had in fact no weight, as the delegates, however chosen, did not represent the people merely as so many individuals, but as forming a sovereign state. Mr. Randolph put it, he said, on his true footing, namely that the public safety superseded the scruple arising from the review of our powers.
Okay, so let me just interrupt you here. Sorry. So one of the things that they talked about, and he wanted to clarify, that when these delegates were chosen by the people out of these two states, that it was inferred that they were the voices of the people, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what he said here. The state of the public mind, it had been observed by Mr. Madison in discussing the first point, that in two states, the delegates to Congress were chosen by the people. Notwithstanding the first appearance of this remark, it had in fact no weight. In other words, even though the people may have selected them, they weren't really representing the people. Notwithstanding, right? That's what he says. So as the delegates, however chosen, did not represent the people merely as so many individuals, but as forming a sovereign state. Mr. Randolph put it, he said, on its true footing, namely that the public safety superseded the scruple arising from the review of our powers. So this is kind of just an injection, because this is Madison's mind putting all these things together. But folks, when you look at the formation of the sovereign states after the Constitution had been ratified, these new states were being adjoined to the Union. The first two states were literally areas, or I would say territories, of existing states. In other words, it was the land of New Hampshire and the land of Virginia that had matured enough to actually become a state, i.e. being Vermont, was the first state that joined the Union after the Constitution, and then Kentucky, which was a Virginia territory, and then Tennessee, which was a North Carolina territory. So if you really look, the two big states that got added were Kentucky and Virginia, Kentucky from Virginia and Tennessee from North Carolina. Those are good, large states. And they were already being organized by the existing state. What I mean by this is long before the Constitutional Convention, when we actually read in the ratification debates, you're going to see the Kentucky delegates. These delegates were representing the territory of Kentucky. I don't know if we see that in the North Carolina, but it did jump out in my mind in the Virginia ratification debates. In other words, these areas were already mature, ripe, and ready to go. Therefore, when they created the Enabling Acts, first off, they made sure that these folks came in with equal footing and equal sovereignty, and that the delegates of the counties would go and convene in a, you know, a specific locale of the territory where they would one then form the state government and the Constitution, just like what they're doing here now. In other words, the parties to the compact, which becomes really, really important down the road, but they don't linger on these things at this point in time because these are just ideas that they're throwing that hopefully, you know, they can assemble something, and they only have so much time, right? They were there for the summer. And this would have been a long boondoggle had they not produced something. And boy, did they produce something. They produced something so close to perfect. And the only reason it wasn't perfect was because of the compromises in placating bad ideas or bad governing concepts and principles like slavery and so forth. So anyway, so back to where you were. We could move forward because Mr. Wilson, you see right there where the parentheses of Mr. Wilson, it's that paragraph or that sentence. He had not himself the same impression and could not therefore dismiss his scruple. Mr. Wilson's contended. See, they're pointing the names of these comments of who he's referring to, right? Because Madison is making track of who's, you know, who's hating on who.
Yeah.
And so he's basically saying, therefore dismiss his scruple. Mr. Wilson contended that as the convention were only to recommend, they might recommend what they pleased. There you go. They were only to recommend. So they recommended and they shot the moon with this, if you understand the expression, because they really went all in to really make a recommendation. And it was, I'd like to say it was literally that contest of the irresistible force and the immovable object, but I believe it was just a foregone conclusion because they had put aside the bad actors. The state legislatures have predominantly been the bad actors against we the people and against, you know, good government and so forth. It only goes to show that when you get these little tyrants, they can be far more petty and far worse than maybe a benevolent king or a good benevolent government. Anyway, if you want to pick it up from there, where he admitted that that criterion?
He differed.
Go ahead.
Okay. He differed much from him. Any act whatever of so respectable a body must have great effect, and if it does not succeed, will be a source of great dissensions. He admitted that there was no certain criterion of the public mind on the subject. He therefore recurred to the evidence of it given by the opposition in the states to the scheme of an impost. It could not be expected that those possessing sovereignty could ever voluntarily part with it. It was not to be expected from any one state, much less from 13. He proceeded to make some observations on the plan itself and arguments urged in support of it. The point of representation could receive no elucidation from the case of England. Their corruption of the boroughs did not proceed from their comparative smallness, but from the actual fewness of the inhabitants, some of them not having more than one or two. A great inequality existed in the counties of England, yet the light complaint of peculiar corruption in the small ones had not been made. It had been said that Congress represent the state prejudices. Will not any other body, whether chosen by the legislatures or the people of the states, also represent their prejudices? It had been asserted by his colleague, Colonel Hamilton, that there was no coincidence of interests among the large states that ought to excite fears of oppression in the smaller. If it were true that such a uniformity of interest existed among the states, there was equal safety for all of them, whether the representation remained as heretofore or were proportioned as now proposed. It is proposed that the general legislature shall have a negative on the laws of the states. It is conceivable that there will be leisure for such a task. Well, that's a question. Is it conceivable that there will be leisure from such a task? Mm-hmm. There will, on the most moderate calculation, be as many acts sent up from the states as there are days in the year.
Okay, so let me highlight something, because there was one little sentence that probably jumped out. This says legislature shall, and I think he's talking about the Congress, the national legislature, shall have a negative on the laws of the states. That was one of the proposals, that the federal government would actually be able to come in and negate any state laws that they felt was contrary to, you know, their authority, power, and what they wanted done. In other words, I don't think people appreciate how the evolution during this convention, because we're now looking, okay, so we're 1 month into this, and there's just a few more months to go, and they're still dealing in a paradigm that this new national government was going to reduce the states to administrative functions. Okay, so go ahead and pick it back up where you were. I just wanted to highlight that one point.
Okay. I'm lost.
So you asked the question underneath that, and then
There will on the most moderate calculation be as many acts sent up from the states as there are days in the year. Will the members of the general legislature be competent judges? Will the gentleman from Georgia be a judge of the expediency of a law which is to operate in New Hampshire? Such a negative would be more injurious than that of Great Britain theretofore was. It is said that the national government must have the influence arising from the grant of offices and honors. In order to render such a government effectual, we believe such an influence to be necessary. But if states will not agree to it, it is in vain. Worse than in vain to make the proposition. If this influence is to be attained, the states must be entirely abolished. Will anyone say this would ever be agreed to? He doubted whether any general government equally beneficial to all can be attained. That now under consideration, he is sure, must be utterly unattainable. He had another objection. The system was too novel and complex. No man could foresee what its operation will be, either with respect to the general government or the state governments. One or other, it has been surmised, must absorb the whole.
Okay, there you go. So one or the other must absorb, it must be surmised that they would absorb the whole. Okay, so now we actually have the first injection of a plan and or an idea or a principle that is putting something into the Constitution that was well beyond the Articles of Confederation. The militia, right? And this is all in blue right after this. And so Colonel Mason then goes into an oration regarding this principle of this militia and what it needed to do. This man was brilliant when it came to the militia. And in the ratification debates of Virginia, he understood the underpinnings, and he understood if the if the states would get away with, or I should say, if the federal government got away with violating the Constitution, that if that was the case, they would do these things to diminish the militia to a point where they would be impotent. And that's exactly what happened shortly after Madison, Monroe, after the Republicans basically lost favor, political favor, and the Democrats started dominating. The militia got downplayed. Even though Andrew Jackson, a huge militia leader that kicked butt in the War of 1812 and took all that credit, allowed everything to be diminished as far as state security so that they could maintain thuggery in the territories. Now, I'm going to present this in a way that's going to be biased because it's my idea, or it's how I see things. And I could be wrong, and that's okay. But I'll just give you my biased opinion here, that when new states were joining into the Union, a caveat had to be added that a state, you can't join the Union unless you can man a militia to secure your safety. You hear me say this a lot when it comes to government. No government should be formed if it can't fund itself. Right? Now, I don't know if I brought this up recently or if you've ever heard me say this, but we have probably 1,000, I'll pull it up, because it's just important to actually do this. So I have the full spreadsheet of the population of the nation from the 2020 census. Now, this is a population of individuals, right? And so when we have 1,000 people, when we got 1,000 people, 1,500, less than 1,500 people in a county, that means that is a total of 66 counties of America have less than 1,500 people. That's families, husband, wife. So if you divided that by two, because nobody had children in these counties, then it would be, instead of 1,500, it would be 750 households in a county. And would 750 households be able to fund the sheriff today? Would they be able to fund the court today? Would they be able to fund the commissioners and an executive, a full government? Yeah, well,
definitely
not. Unless these counties, these 66 counties, were very affluent, where Bill Gates and those kind of people live, right? And I'm going to tell you that when you're looking at these counties, these are very rural counties and probably pretty poor. And so when you add on to these 66, and so give me a number that you think population-wise you would need to have, people-wise, for a self-sustaining government, for just those basic functions.
30,000.
30,000, okay. All right, so we're going to go up to how many counties are there that have less than 30,000 people? In other words, incapable of sustaining themselves, right? Incapable of doing that. So, okay, I'm almost there. Yep, there we go. I've got it. Okay, that means that there are 1,700 counties incapable of sustaining itself with less than 30,000. That's almost half of the counties of America. It's around half. Half of the counties can't sustain themselves because they don't have 30,000 people. And I agree with you. And I think that 30,000 is a very good number for a reasonable government that would not be burdensome to the people. Because if not, that county, because it can't sustain itself, everybody, all the other counties in the state are going to subsidize it. That's not right.
Right.
I say, if I'm subsidizing you, I want to have control with how my money's being used. Right?
That's usually how it goes.
Yes, it usually is. He who pays the piper calls the tune. And so when the state legislature is involved in administering welfare to counties, do you think that they actually strong-armed? Absolutely they do. Yeah. So why would you want to have a government that would be susceptible to that? The only way you could be a sovereign bodied government, like a county, is you have to be able to sustain yourself. And I'm telling you, in Washington State, we have many counties that need to adjoin, where we, you know, there are two or three counties need to join together. I think the county I live in is just above 30,000. I think it just above that. But there are some neighboring counties that just couldn't do it. They'd have to adjoin to us just to get to that number. So yeah. Anyway, the point is that when we're looking at what these guys are talking about, we're not even talking about the militia. Now you have to have a militia. Now, fortunately, the militia is funded by the federal government, the arming of the militia and the training of the militia. But when you get them out into serving, because what's the militia supposed to do? Well, instead of actually having deputies, the sheriff is supposed to, and should be using the militia. They should be active members of the militia that are a part of his department. And you know what? What happens is everybody wants to have the people they like and the people that will do their bidding. And that creates problems because it allows characters and personalities to actually go down some very evil paths, bad paths in governing that a sheriff could easily do. This way, if you actually had and you used the militia and rotated them where the sheriff really wouldn't have control over that, then he would have to actually make lemonade out of lemons. He would actually have to be able to lead people on the principles instead of do what I told you to do or those types of things. It changes everything by actually implementing and using the militia as not only your defense force for the county, but your police force of executing the laws. So when we get into this, we don't have time today, but we'll lead on this for tomorrow. And so we're going to dive into what Mason kind of talks about in introducing the militia into the conversation. This is a good oration of his, and it's even followed by somebody else that's, you know, agreed upon. But we need, when we think about our counties and we think about taking back our states, I think you're going to, folks, some of you, if this happens, some of you will need to be open and actually be recommending and leading on the idea of adjoining two counties or three counties where, you know, you actually can sustain yourself, because then you become a sovereign body. If you're not dependent on people or anybody else to support you, then that means you're not controlled by that state legislature or anyone else. So. Mm-hmm. I submit that for your consideration. I'm not the king, but, you know, I think sound reasoning should always prevail. Common sense, logic, and reason, right? Anyway, thank you so much for all your assistance and help. I know this is tough reading. I know it's tough. So thank you so much for hanging in there. And folks, with that, we will be back tomorrow. We're still covering Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. We're going to dive into some ideas that are going to be presented regarding the militia. So you're going to probably want to hear this, along with a lot of these other things that are very critical in how these ideas formulated into the Constitution. I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract and with Republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic review. Please read my argument for Republic review, as well as my description of the Republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.